WBR Fairfax Radio. I'm Sue Bartholomew. Welcome to On the Commons. On the Commons with me today is Paul Steinberg. Paul is an attorney and a co-op owner in New York City. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, good to be here.
I know you're sitting there sweltering. Just before we went on the air, Paul told me that they turned off the air conditioner in his office building, and so it's pretty warm in there. So we'll try to keep it nice and cool on the show for you, okay, Paul? I really appreciate you joining me today.
Oh, no problem at all.
Can we start off by explaining what a co-op is? I usually, you know, introduce the show and say that, you know, homeowners associations, we talk about PUDs and condominiums and cooperatives because they make up a very small portion of common ownership developments, but nobody seems to know a whole lot about them.
Well, co-ops actually were, in many ways, the predecessor of condos and homeowner associations, and there's a lot of similarities. I think we need to remember that in the early days of the American Republic, there was plenty of land, plenty of space, and so people did not have to have these common ownership structures. And what happened was in the late 1800s in New York, because of the fact that there's a very small amount of real estate, particularly Manhattan, it's an island, because of that, you started seeing the earliest forms of cooperative ownership, which were the co-ops. And the irony is that co-ops, although now people that have, which we can discuss a little bit later, now people that have sufficient amounts of money tend to prefer to avoid many homeowner associations, co-ops, condos. In the early days, in the 1800s, cooperative ownership was actually targeted at wealthy people. The idea being that you would travel to Europe or travel to, you know, Asia or wherever, and you'd be able to come back and you would share some of the common costs. And as a matter of fact, the earliest case, New York has the earliest homeowner association cooperative case in New York was dated back to 1886. So what happened is that co-ops essentially are it's a hybrid between stock ownership, such as you would own stock in, say, IBM, and owning property. And therein lies a lot of the problem. In a cooperative, what happens is the, let's say the simple example, you've got an apartment building with, say, 50 units. And each of those 50 people buys a certain number of shares in a company, the cooperative organization, which buys the building and the underlying land, and then issues each one of those 50 people a lease called a proprietary lease for their apartment.
So they basically don't own land. They're basically buying shares in a corporation.
That is correct. And that causes a degree of consternation in the courts, as well as with people buying these, because a lot of people don't understand, in particular with co-ops, people don't understand that they are not really buying a home in the traditional sense, that they are subject to intrusive inspections and the will of their neighbors, more specifically the board of directors of the cooperative itself.
Well, that seems to be becoming such a part of American life nowadays, regardless of what form of housing you're in, even if you're in a million-dollar single-family home.
That is very true. What has happened is, for much the same reasons that 100 years ago cooperatives became widespread in New York and started in New York and became widespread in this century, for many of the same reasons, you are seeing the development of homeowner associations and condominium associations in other parts of the country. For example, you look at a place like California, where you have very heavy development. You look at a place like Northern Virginia. I used to live in Arlington myself.
Yeah.
Because of the increasing density, and because of the fact that what's happening now with a lot of developments is that you have one developer will buy up a parcel and set up an association. In terms of percentages, the ownership of these type of structures, be they homeowner associations, co-ops, condos, is going to increase, and that is precisely why some of the precedents that have been being set in terms of the amount of control are very troubling. And it's something that I think a lot of people don't realize when they buy into these associations.
Well, they seem to want, you know, if they are aware of it at all, they seem to think that they're going to be protected, that the association is there to control their neighbor, certainly not them.
Well, that is true. People always feel that, well, I don't have to worry about this because I'll behave, and
yeah.
This is a check on my neighbor not behaving.
I can't do anything wrong. I mean, how could anybody disagree with me or disprove of anything I do, right, Paul?
Exactly. And the problem, to be honest with you, I think a lot of the problem you seem to have a disconnect when you look at the legal opinions and you look at the reality. And I think the reason for that is because of the fact that a lot of these judges themselves make decent amounts of money. They don't have to subject themselves to this. And also their lawyers, and by and large, to the extent that lawyers are living in these type of arrangements, people tend to leave the lawyers alone. They figure if we make trouble for the neighbor who's a lawyer, he'll sue us. The problem is that in reality, when the board of directors of any of these organizations, be it co-op, condo, HOAs, when the board of directors gets in, people tend to, you know, it's like Lord Acton, 300-400 years ago, he talked about power corrupting.
And absolute power corrupting, absolutely right.
And that's exactly what you happen. You have really, because these people tend to be entrenched. And it's very much like dealing with Congress or, you know, the old Soviet Politburo. You know, there are advantages to incumbency. I'll give you an example. I live in a co-op myself.
Okay.
And in the co-op that I live in, you have the annual shareholder meeting where basically no one bothers attending because they know it's pretty much foreordained, you know, who's in and who's out. And so they really have no voice. And one of the things that happens is that the cooperative, the members of the board, will go around to the people and say, hey, we need your proxy. Now, if you get the president of the board coming up to you and saying, oh, I need your proxy for the meeting, okay,
mm-hmm.
you're going to sign it because you don't want trouble with the board. Conversely, if you give your proxy to, say, John Doe, who's not happy and who wants to go there and raise some issues of concern,
yeah.
well, if you give your proxy to John Doe at the meeting,
yeah.
John Doe is going to say, hey, I have Paul Steinberg's proxy. Well, the board knows then you're a troublemaker.
Oh, so it's intimidation.
Well, it's a very gentle form of intimidation, but I would say yes. I would say it is intimidation. And so what happens is that you have a situation where the board can get control. The board members may only own a few shares, but because of their ability to get the proxies, it's very much like a corporation. I mean, if you look, the major corporations, management owns very little, if any, of the shares of these big companies. But they control it because of the fact they can develop alliances with the people that do control. In the case of co-ops, the co-op board knows who's voting with and against them. We're not talking secret voting here. And so when you give a proxy to somebody who's a dissident, you are asking for a heightened scrutiny by the board. And one of the problems that you're having right now in New York, for example, there was a recent case, the Pullman case that you referenced earlier.
Yeah. We're going to be getting into that, folks, so.
What's that?
I said we're going to be getting into that, so stay tuned. You're going to want to hear this one.
What you've had happen is that case, which we'll discuss in a little bit, in that case, essentially what is troubling about that, and what you and I were discussing before the show went on, what is troubling here with Pullman is that it is giving increased power. Now, the Pullman decision related to a co-op board, but if you look at the underlying rationale of that case, you can apply that same rationale to condos and homeowner associations. And that's why when you are giving more power to these boards that are very intrusive, at some point, I would think at some point the action that's got to be taken is legislative, because the judge of the courts don't seem to be understand the distinction. And at some point, as you mentioned, this is a growing way of owning your home. And at some point, my guess is you're going to start to see some action in the various state legislatures to rein in the power of these boards.
We're starting to see that, Paul. The problem is there's no real adult supervision involved. You know, the legislature will come in and they'll give, you know, they'll take away certain powers or they'll give certain rights back to the individual homeowners. But they won't help enforce those laws like they will any other law they come up with. Then the it's up to the individual to hire an attorney and go to court to enforce that law.
Well, and that can be hugely expensive. I think one of the things that you have to remember is, and I'm a little bit more familiar with New York law than other parts of the country, but I think it illustrates your point. The two leading cases in New York in the last 15 years on this point, one of them involved a building on Park Avenue, where all the parties involved were multimillionaires. And in the Pullman case itself, Mr. Pullman is a very wealthy bond trader who's worth, my understanding is, in excess of $50 million to $100 million. So you're talking people that have very deep pockets. You're correct. In a lot of cases, what happens is people cannot afford to vindicate their rights.
That's right.
And what's even more troubling is if you look in a lot of these organizations, there is in whatever documents you sign, and then the name of the document varies depending on, you know, whether you're talking HOA, condo, or co-op. But essentially, at some point, you sign something saying, hey, I agree to abide by the rules. Very often, if you look in that document, there will be something that says, if we have to bring litigation against you, or if we have to do any kind of action against you, even if it does not actually end up in court, you agree to pay our attorney's fees.
Oh, it's one-sided?
It is. Now, if you go to court, many times the judges, in particular where you're dealing with individuals, and in these type of things, you're by definition, you're dealing with individuals, in many cases, the judge will be reluctant. A lot of times the courts apply, for want of a legal term, what's a sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander approach. And so if you get to court, in many cases, if your attorney prevails and asks for fees, and the association or co-op says, oh, well, it's a one-sided provision, in many cases, you can prevail by pointing out to the judge, look, this is a one-sided, you know, we won, and therefore we should be entitled. And believe it or not, there are cases where the judges have said, you know something, if it's sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander, and you know what, you, board or association, you lost, and so you're going to pay the legal fees. But two things. First of all, in order to do that, you have to go through the litigation. You have to spend the money. The second thing is you have to win. And then the third thing is you have to persuade the judge to award you the fees. Now, a lot of times what happens is these things don't even get to court, because what will happen is that you'll get a letter, say, from the attorney for the board or the association. And the letter will say, we find that you've done this, this, and that, and this is against the rules, and you've got to stop it. Now, in your next month's bill, you'll find a little charge on there for $500, $1,000, whatever, for
legal
fees.
Yeah.
Now, what are you going to do? It's going to cost you more to litigate that, and if you don't pay that, then, of course, you get late fees and all that on top of that, and ultimately they'll bring you to court. The point is it's a no-win situation. And what is troubling is where the courts are saying to people, well, you know, this you had the right to enter into this contract or not, and you signed up, boom, that's it. And so to
you
some
agreed,
extent,
basically.
I'm sorry?
You agreed, basically. It's, you know, you said that this is what you're going to do now. Live up to your end of the bargain.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. And certainly, for, you know, conceptually, you can understand that there's some merit to that argument. People really should read these documents more closely. People should do that.
But, Paul, if they decide they don't like it, is there an alternative for them? There isn't in Virginia. I mean, Northern Virginia, it's 90% in associations.
Right.
And the documents are all essentially the same.
And well, it's interesting because I used to own a Subway sandwich franchise for many years, and what strikes me is that many of the issues that you see in franchising relating to stronger and weaker parties, relating to application of good faith and fair dealing among the parties, a lot of those same issues, as a former franchisee and as a co-op owner and as an attorney, I see a congruence between them. And a lot of the issues that you're raising are ones that I've actually done research on for some years. And you're right. First of all, the fact of the matter is, in a lot of parts of the country, Northern Virginia is one area, parts of California, a lot of California is another area, the northern suburbs of New York are another area. All of the housing that's coming onto the market, certainly all of the housing that's even moderately affordable, is in these various types of associations. And so I would argue that given that you're talking about something that is so fundamental, i.e. people's home, given the fact you're talking about something that's so fundamental, I would argue there's a difference, which the courts don't seem to be grasping. There is a difference between being owning a part of General Motors and owning a part of your homeowner association. Huge difference. And in fact, in the lower court Pullman case, in the trial level Pullman case, the dissenting justices did make a distinction between that. They said, look, what we're talking about here is someone getting thrown out of their home. And this is a totally different ballpark from your standard, you're a member of this, or you're a part owner of this association or company or stockholder or whatever. And so, you know, it different ball game. We're talking, you know, you're not talking, you're a shareholder in a company that's manufacturing widgets. You're talking about the fact that you're a shareholder in a corporation that owns your house.
That's right. Can we talk about the Pullman case now? Now, David Pullman was one of these guys who decided that he was not, you know, he could do no wrong, and he started pointing the finger at other members, and he ended up being ousted, right?
Well, David Pullman is actually a very colorful character. I've never met him, although in the interests of full disclosure, I should mention that I have had some dealings with his father as an attorney representing the other side of a deal his father was involved in. So just full disclosure there. I never met David Pullman or spoken with him, but David Pullman is fairly well known in the New York financial community. You may remember that, you know, the singer David Bowie?
Yes.
Okay. Some years back, David Bowie wanted to raise like 140, 150 something million, a huge amount of money, multi-millions.
Mm-hmm.
And David Pullman securitized his song catalog and sold bonds against it, which colloquially became known as Bowie bonds. And that made David Pullman tons and tons of money, got him huge visibility. The guy made a lot of money. And in fairness, from what I understand and people I've talked to, he is a self-made man. The problem is that he's not exactly the type of person you'd want to have for a neighbor. And this is, therein lies the rub here.
Okay.
If you look at, and again, I'm just basing this on the public record, okay, not on anything other than the public record. If you look at the trial, the lower level court, it goes into, at some length, some of the things Mr. Pullman did. Among other things, he wrote in the space of 1 month, he wrote 16 letters to the board complaining. He got into a fight with his upstairs neighbor. The allegation was that there was actually physical force used against the upstairs neighbor, who was a retired professor. David Pullman, by all accounts, was a difficult person to live with. And I think that we should note that none of his neighbors did stick up for him. The vote to vote him off the island, so to speak, was unanimous.
Was unanimous, yes.
It was unanimous. But here's the problem. If you look at what happened with Mr. Pullman was obviously someone who was a difficult tenant. Certainly the other people didn't want to have him there, and there are legitimate grounds for getting rid of Mr. Pullman. And you got to remember, prior to the Pullman, the whole reason the Pullman case went to New York's highest court is because of the fact that there was a shift in how the cooperative board dealt with the problem shareholder. Traditionally, prior to Pullman, the traditional way of doing this was that you would have to go to court in front of a judge and prove that somebody was objectionable, that they were creating a nuisance in the building, and therefore that their tenancy had to be terminated.
Can I interrupt you here for just a second, Paul?
Yes.
I want to make a point that he did not owe any money. He wasn't in arrears. It's not that he didn't pay his dues.
No, Mr. Pullman had more money than you and I will ever see in our life. He's an enormously wealthy man.
Okay, so but the sole reason the co-op got rid of him was because he was difficult.
Yes.
Not because he owed any money, not because he violated any rules or covenants or anything else like that. They just simply did not want him there anymore.
Correct.
Okay.
And in fairness, I think I've got to say, Shu, that if you or I were his neighbors, we probably wouldn't want him there either.
Probably not. But Paul, this sort of begs the bigger issue, the bigger question. Suppose you didn't like what the board was doing. Suppose I didn't like what the board was doing, and you gave me your proxy or vice versa. You know, can they then turn around and say, well, gee whiz, you're difficult. You're not going with the flow, and therefore we want to terminate your membership.
Now, this is the heart of the matter.
Yes.
When I had a discussion with somebody that knows David Pullman, the person raised the totally valid point that, you know what, David Pullman has enough money to buy, he can buy half of Manhattan Island, okay? The problem is that the New York's highest court, which is influential in other parts of the country, especially in an area like this, because of the fact that New York has such a well-established body of law in this, it is looked to by other parts of the country. What they did here is going to have an impact on people long after Mr. Pullman is gone, number one, and number two, most people don't have tens of millions of dollars. And what has happened here is when the highest court in New York looked at this, they said that the standard that we're going to apply is what they call business judgment rule. That is a very, very deferential standard. That's not a standard that you normally see in any kind of housing action. Any kind of holdover, ejectment, any kind of termination at least, you have a very high standard. You actually have to do some work. Business judgment rule is something that you don't see in real estate. Business judgment rule is what you see in managing a corporation. You know, if the managers of Apple Computer make a decision to, buy or sell a plant or to hire or fire somebody, that's the board's business judgment. And the courts, in the context of shareholder ownership of companies, you know, like on Wall Street buying and selling stocks, the courts have generally said, listen, you've got professional managers in there, your shareholders, you know, as long as the board is exercising its business judgment, we'll defer to that. The problem that you have when you apply the business judgment standard to someone's home is precisely what you pointed out, that business judgment is it's a very amorphous standard. It's essentially, it's very deferential, very amorphous. Mm-hmm. What you're saying essentially is if the board doesn't like you, assuming that they follow the proper policies, they can kick you out.
That's pretty scary. I mean, I'm not going to comment on Mr. Pullman's personality or characteristics or, you know, or his behavior. My concern, my only concern, is that if we go down this road, where will it lead to?
Yes. Yes. And I think that one of the things that you've got to realize, and this is what's troubling, most of these cases are not going to get into what they call the reporters, the reported law decisions. A lot of these won't even get to court. As I mentioned, the one New York decision was about 10 years ago related to a cooperative on Park Avenue or a condo on Park Avenue. Mr. Pullman was on, he was on 67th Street and 5th Avenue, one of the most expensive areas in the country to live. These were people that had money. Most people don't have money to fight this, and what's happened is that you've had some decisions where essentially the courts have said the board has broad powers. Now, I'll tell you where this has an impact. The building that I live in, for example, is not really a terribly, like, fancy building or anything, and people there, they don't know the name. Oh, Pullman, you know, the West 67th Street versus Pullman, they don't know the name of the case. But what they do know, because it was reported in the popular media here, is that the if you tick off the board of directors, you can be voted out of your home. That's the message people got.
That's kind of scary. And that's in essence what it is, isn't it?
Essentially, that is. The court, in the Pullman case, the court, I think, was troubled. The high court was troubled by the implications of its decision. And so it speaks in there of a good faith, that the board's actions have to be in good faith. The problem is that, as any attorney can tell you, good faith is good faith as a practical matter is not what it was 10 or 15 years ago. As a matter of fact, Justice Scalia said that people can contract around good faith, and that in a properly drafted contract, good faith is irrelevant. That's what he said. And that's in the timeshare decision that Justice Scalia authored. So the courts around the country, and you've got Scalia, who's on the U.S. Supreme Court. You look at Judge Posner in Easterbrook out in Chicago. In New York, New York's leading case on good faith was Kirk Lachelle, dating back to the Great Depression, and even in that case, the court said that, well, every contract has obligations of good faith, but you can contract around it.
Mm.
So where this comes into play is if the only restriction on the actions of the board is a business judgment standard and the fact that they're acting in good faith. And the thing is, you got to realize what the burden, the onus, is on the person being thrown out to show that the board was acting in bad faith.
So basically, we're flipping the Constitution on its ear.
I would say so. Obviously, the highest court in New York disagreed. But interestingly, if you look. And see, this is where I think you know, some of your listeners might have an insight that the New York Court of Appeals in New York is the highest court. Your listeners might have an insight that the highest court in New York doesn't have. Your listeners live in these communities; they know the reality.
That's right.
And I think it's worth noting in the Pullman case that the trial court decision, which came out of the First Department, which covers the Bronx and Manhattan. These are judges that live here. Okay, these are judges. The only cases that they hear are appeals that start out in the Bronx and Manhattan. Okay, so they're here. They're on the ground. They know what it's like. In that case, you had a strong dissent. The lower court was split, and they argued, you know, both sides, very much the dissent was arguing along the lines of what we're talking about here, that, look, we got to face the reality. This is not a routine a shareholder or partnership, a business type of arrangement. This is someone's home. Now, it goes up to the highest court. You're dealing with people that are in northern, these are people up in Albany. You don't have the it's not like, say, New York City or northern Virginia or areas that have very high homeowner association and co-op ownership. These people all live in their own homes. They don't deal with this, and that's why, although you had a vigorous debate locally, when the Manhattan court looked at this, the first department looked at this, they had a vigorous back and forth. Goes up to Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals, unanimous decision. Unanimous decision saying, oh, it's no biggie. They can vote them off the island.
Oh,
I think these people have been watching too much Survivor.
I think that's what I put them up for. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. This is absolutely fascinating. We're talking to Paul Steinberg today, and you're on the Commons, and we'll be right back. Don't go away.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Joining us on the Commons today is Paul Steinberg. Paul is an attorney in New York City, a co-op owner, and we've been talking about the Pullman case. This is the case about a guy who was basically voted out of his own home. Thank you so much for being with us, Paul.
Oh, hi. Glad to be back.
I hope it's not too hot.
No, it's actually very comfortable up here in New York.
Oh, is it good? Because it's like a bowl of pea soup here in Virginia.
There's a little bit of humidity high up. I'm in the Empire State Building, so you can actually see the lines where the humidity stops and starts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If you're up, you got to stop by. It's a wonderful view.
Sounds great. Well, I definitely will. We were talking about, actually, we were kind of talking about due process, I think, where the board just unilaterally voted this guy off, or actually the owners voted this guy out of the association without. They did give him the opportunity to come and be heard, correct?
They did. I'd like to get to that in a second, but you raised a very interesting point briefly in passing that I think that for some of your listeners that don't have a legal background, I think is worth discussing briefly here. You had mentioned in terms of the due process.
Mm-hmm.
And in a colloquial sense of the term, they didn't give him due process. What I've been asked by a lot of people is, well, why can't this go up to the Supreme Court? Why can't this go as a federal constitutional due process issue? And I think that one of the things that people need to understand is that the issue of due process here, if there were what they call state action. In other words, if somehow the government was funding, you know, the government, there was government funding involved with this particular building, or if there was government action or something, you could raise this argument in federal court. The problem right now for Mr. Pullman, it's not so much a problem for Mr. Pullman, but for all of those of us that are affected by this decision. The problem is that you've had the highest court in New York that has set a policy, and it's going to be very difficult because unless there are some grounds to get this into federal court, that decision, at least with respect to New York, is going to stand. And with respect to people in the rest of the country, the New York Court of Appeals is the highest court in New York, and because of the fact that New York has so much of this type of ownership, not only condos, not only co-ops, but also co-op condos and homeowner associations, this is going to be a very influential decision. And so in terms of due process, if this were federal, very clearly you'd have a serious issue and one that could be litigated in federal court. The problem is that the board is a private organization. And so from their perspective, they gave Mr. Pullman due process. And I think that in fairness to the high court, their decision in Pullman, I think that we must remember that the court's decision did very explicitly raise the point that Mr. Pullman had been notified of the objections that the board had to what he was doing. Mr. Pullman was notified that there was going to be a meeting of the shareholders. Mr. Pullman was given an opportunity, if he chose to do so, of going to the meeting and speaking his defense, and that Mr. Pullman chose not to respond, not to go to the meeting, not to put anything in his defense, and ultimately they had 75% of the votes were there, either in person or by proxy, and the votes that were cast were unanimous to throw him out.
Now, let me ask you something here, Paul. If he had gone in, I mean, he would be talking to the very board and appealing to the very board who had decided to get rid of him in the first place, right?
Correct. And the
so there's no separation.
Well, if I think this is why the people that have not been in this type of living arrangement, they really can't conceive of this, because it's like, as you mentioned earlier, when you go into this type of arrangement, you say, well, I'll never be a problem to my neighbors. So people are clueless as to, until you've actually been in the situation, they're clueless as to how much power the board wields. And I'm sure that people that have not been in one of these associations are probably out there listening and saying, well, you know what, if that were me, and they tried doing that to me, I'm a nice person, and my neighbors would rally around me, and they wouldn't be able to do this.
Very funny.
But, as we said earlier, the problem is that the boards have tremendous power, and nobody really wants to speak up against the board. That's a very, very dangerous thing to do. And, of course, the irony of it all is Pullman has made that, the Pullman decision made that even more dangerous to do. So, although theoretically Mr. Pullman was granted due process, not in the governmental sense, but in the sense that, say, you and I might use the term, although he was granted due process, had he shown up, I would rather doubt that anybody would have been brave enough under the circumstances to stand up against the board. And I don't know why he did or didn't, he didn't show up. I don't know why he did not show up. My guess, frankly, is that very similar to the co-op I'm in, no one ever shows up for the annual meeting because people know it's a farce.
What a mess.
It is. I would just one anecdote to illustrate. I actually showed up at early on when I bought my co-op. I actually showed up at the annual meeting, and I said, well, during the year, when are those meetings scheduled? Because I'd like to, you know, can we get notice to people so that if people have an issue, they can come in and raise the issue. Now, I live in a very small building. There's only 38 units in my building, so you would think, if anything, this would be a more relaxed and informal group of people.
Uh-huh.
I was told by the president of the board, I mean, it looked like I had passed gas in church, you know, and he looks at me and he says, now, if you have a problem, you contact the super. The super will contact the managing agent. The managing agent will bring it to our attention at the next meeting. If we feel a response is warranted, we will send that response back through the managing agent. I can't make this stuff up. This is in a 38-unit building.
It sounds absolutely preposterous here.
It is. I mean, you know, and I think that you're starting seeing some of these stories are percolating through. I mean, what strikes me is when you start seeing appearances of this in popular culture. I don't know if you saw the X-Files episode.
Oh yeah.
Oh, that was absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
For your readers that aren't familiar, it was the Homeowner Association from Hell, literally speaking. And the president of the association summoned the demons of darkness to deal with recalcitrant, you know, homeowners. You know, you had that. You had the Third Rock from the Sun episode, which was more lighthearted. It wasn't quite as such a dark view, but the Third Rock from the Sun episode, which was absolutely hilarious, and I think illustrated exactly the point we were talking about earlier about once people get on these boards. You had the character played by Sally, the very attractive blonde character, and she, when they moved into the building and she was placed on the board, all of a sudden she turned from this very nice, mellow, happy person into this very dominating, controlling type that the when they would hold the meetings, everybody in the audience, all of the tenants were cringing in fear. Now this is in popular culture. These are two very well known, very well known, highly rated TV shows, and that's why I do think that as you're starting seeing some of these stories percolating, I think that you may see some pressure for some kind of legislative action. Now in the short term, this does affect people's values of their homes.
Okay, that's what I'm. All right, you have a theory about that.
Well, as you know, the reason actually we first got to speaking was because of the email bulletin board discussion that on one of the bulletin boards dealing with real estate, and there was some discussion of the Pullman case, because, like I said, this has attracted attention around the country because it has very broad implications, and the academics that were responding were all coming in with the difference in valuation is due to tax things and the underlying mortgage and this and that. And my response to that is, get real. Anybody that's actually lived in these things knows that people go into these, as you mentioned, Northern Virginia, all of the new housing coming online.
That's right.
Is in these developments. So you don't have a choice. If you have the money, you're going to go buy that house on your own plot of land. You know, the traditional concept, the traditional Anglo-American concept of your home is your castle.
That's right.
I mean, and you know something, nowadays people think, oh, this is a little bit corny. The fact is that this is a powerful theme in the law, and I think it's worth remembering if you look at the Declaration of Independence. One of the reasons given was the issue of, in that case, it was specifically quartering troops in the home. But this is in the Declaration of Independence. There is a long tradition, even going back to the days when the monarchy was very powerful, there is a long tradition of talking about the sanctity of a home. You know, some of your viewers may see sometimes on television the shows where these cop shows, where when they go to arrest somebody and they do something to get him to step over the threshold of his home and arrest him then.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. And the reason, and the cases vary from state to state. In New York, I believe the cases, the principal is Peyton, I believe it is. The reason for that is because of the fact that there is a big distinction. The government, once you step outside that threshold, in New York, for example, the government can arrest you without a warrant. In your home, there's a different standard because of this traditional view going back before the country was even founded, going back to Old England, that your home is your castle. And what's happened now is because of the fact that your home is no longer your castle, in New York, for example, I know several real estate brokers. They don't buy in co-ops. They'll go for a condo. They'll go for a house. I had a good friend of mine could have qualified for any of the Manhattan co-ops. He said, no way. He went out on Long Island so he could get afford to buy a house. Okay.
It's interesting, Paul, because whenever I have members of the community associations industry on, and these are the guys who are constantly pushing these common ownership developments, I always ask them, do you live in an association? And they don't. None of them do.
And that's why I'm saying what you have is this dichotomy between the theoretical from an economic, from a jurisprudential standpoint. You have all of this conceptual stuff that's really nice, which is what these homeowner industry people put out, which is what the courts are swallowing. But then you have the reality. And the reality is human nature being what it is. Unfortunately, when people get onto these boards, they tend to, particularly if you're dealing with people that don't have anything better to do with their time, and I'm not saying that to be facetious. I think that, based on my experience, I think that's a very real issue. When people, a lot of times, these boards tend to attract people that have a lot of time, and they tend to attract, like when you were in fifth grade, the people that would volunteer to be hall monitors and check your hall pass.
That's right.
Okay. Those are the type of people that you're getting.
The bullies.
Yeah. Yeah, you're getting people. I had my next door neighbor sits on the board, and I actually, he would, when he was, especially like when he had friends of his over.
Yeah.
When he would go in and out of the building, he would stop people and say, who are you? Where are you going?
You get that a lot. I know you told me about that. Your friends refuse to come and see you anymore.
I had several of my friends. As a matter of fact, my best friend passed away from a heart attack in April.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Great guy. We actually did business. We owned various businesses together. 13 years we did business. He was a wonderful person. We did all our business with handshake, nothing in writing. That's the type of person. He was very nice, very mellow, totally trustworthy, nice guy. He would come and visit me. He stopped. As a matter of fact, the morning he passed away, we were getting together to discuss one of the businesses that we owned, and we were getting together having a breakfast meeting going over this. And I said, well, just come on up and, knock on the door, and then we'll go out to a restaurant and go over the stuff. He goes, no, I'll meet you at the restaurant. Because I am not. Now, this is somebody who, he was a nice guy, but understand, this is somebody that could take care of himself. He was in the 82nd Airborne, okay?
Okay.
I mean, this is not somebody that shied away. But he's like, something, this just isn't worth it. He goes, move out. I actually had friends of mine that really would not come and visit because of the fact. Now, ultimately, what I ended up doing was I actually called the, then he was president. He's still on the board, no longer president. I actually called him up. And I just said, look, I said, this is ridiculous. Basically my position on this is if there's any problems, you go ahead, you talk to the board's attorney, you have the attorney initiate a lawsuit, I said, and we'll deal with it in court. I said, but you do not go harassing people visiting me. I mean, it's absolutely insane. Absolutely insane. And much as we see some of these stories and we look at television and some of the things are kind of funny, I think that we got to realize, and I think that ultimately what these industry representatives need to realize is that people are being affected by this in the most intimate, personal area of their life, their
That's
home.
That's right. That's right. And most people just want to be left alone.
Yeah. Yeah. There is actually a phrase in real estate law, a quiet enjoyment.
That's right.
That you are entitled to the quiet enjoyment of your premises. And the irony is, I've actually rented in co-op buildings. As a renter in a co-op building, you have far more rights than as an owner, at least in New York.
That seems to be pretty universal, not just with co-ops.
Yeah.
But renters seem to have more rights than owners.
because of the fact that the courts are willing to say, you know, something. It's the quiet enjoyment principle. That, look, this is someone's home. As long as they're not bothering anybody, leave them alone, point number one. Point number two, if you feel they're bothering either you as the landlord or the tenants or whatever, neighbors, whatever, then you need to prove somehow that there's a problem here. You can't just at your whim throw people out of their homes. And I've lived as a renter and not had a problem because of the fact that as a renter you're protected by a whole group of laws. But when you're dealing with a quiet, technically, and again, it depends on what kind of an association you're in. If you're in a co-op, by definition, you have a proprietary lease. If you're in something like a homeowner association, that's a little bit of a different story, and it depends on how your documents are worded. But even with a co-op, where you would think you have strong rights because of the fact that what you have is actually a lease, so you would think if anything there, you would have the closest thing to the rights that a renter possesses. Pullman indicates quite clearly that you don't. And if you don't have those rights in a co-op, imagine in an HOA where it is a more attenuated issue, where you're, where you don't actually have a lease per se.
That's right.
That's the problem. That's the problem.
And
I think, you know, to go back to your earlier point on the valuation issue, there is considerable debate on how the valuation issue plays. I'm sure you've had, since you've had folks from the industry on, I'm sure you've heard their argument, and their argument has some merit in some cases. Their argument is this. They say, well, by virtue of the fact that we can exercise control over our surroundings, that all of us communally can take care, we know what we want, and we can together as a commune get together and enforce the standards, and thereby ensure peace and happiness and harmony, as opposed to, you know, the more freewheeling capitalist system. I mean it's very much like the old, and I'm being quite serious on this, it's very much like the philosophical arguments for the either communism or the planned communities that you saw in the U.S. in the post-Civil War era. And none of these communities really worked out, either in the United States or abroad. These communities didn't work out, and the reason is that you have this difference, this distinction between the theory and the reality. And from my perspective, I would think that if these, especially given the fact that these are a growing way of ownership in the United States, given that at some point the legislatures and the people living here in these HOAs, condos, co-ops, have to start standing up and saying, listen, you know something, we need to be reasonable. We need to be respectful of our neighbors' privacy and of their rights to live in quiet enjoyment. We need to respect their rights to be left alone. And unfortunately, the Pullman case pulls us in the exact opposite.
Yeah, it does. Paul, thank you so much for joining me today. Would you believe we're out of time?
Oh, I know. I just noticed that.
And you just thought we were just getting going. You've done a great job. Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back again sometime.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful being with you guys. It's wonderful. I absolutely, I'll tell you, if it were up to me, if I didn't have business here in New York, I think Northern Virginia is a much nicer place to live than New York, frankly.
Well, I don't know. It's getting to be a little bit more like New York every day, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I was actually down there when they were developing Tyson's Corner, and a lot of people were saying, there were people from New York that were saying, you know, this is looking too much like New York.
Yeah, well, it's really overdeveloped now. But, Paul, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on. And for the rest of you, thanks for joining us and hanging out with us on the Commons today. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Stay tuned and stay free.